For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. I'm Brian Taylor, and I've given two or three talks here before, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. I'm very aware of tonight of how grateful I am for all of you and for this Sangha and for being a part of it for the last 5 years, and what a beginner I am, and how much I have learned and will continue to learn from all of you, which is maybe a good position to start on for tonight's talk, because I'm going to be talking about not knowing. and I want to start with case 20 from the Book of Serenity. Fayan was on pilgrimage and was lost in a snowstorm, so the story goes, and he came upon the monastery where Dijong was abbot. And Dijong asked Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dijong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fayan said, "I don't know." Dijong responded, "Not knowing is most intimate." Or sometimes I think it's translated as closest, or what else? What other translations are there? Nearest? Yeah. Anyway, there's a sense that this a lot of the monks at that time went from monastery to monastery and learning from different teachers for different periods of time. And during this time of being a pilgrim, I can really see that. I was talking with a student at U Chicago recently at the Rockefeller Chapel group that we have on Wednesdays down there, and she was taking the spring break week to go on a retreat. It wasn't a session. She went to a monastery to just spend time and in solitude and read and meditate and things like that. And she was talking to me about what she was doing, and she had all these purposes and plans and things that she was going to do when she got there and books she was going to read. And I said, "Well, you know, you could do that. And there's another approach which would be more like Fayan here, which is I really don't know why I'm going or what's going to happen. I'm just going to try to remain open and see what comes up and how I need to respond then." And she you could see her sort of relax and just go, "Oh, I can do that." That's, I think, what she did. So to start off, knowing is a good thing. As well as not knowing. It's often helpful. I mean, obviously, we need to gain expertise in things and knowledge about things, become, you know, be able to fix things and create things and be effective, hopefully, in work and in the world. Knowing what our tradition teaches, you know, maybe knowing what the precepts are and thinking about them, having some base of knowledge about them, some self-knowledge is very helpful. Some things like therapy can help a lot with that, knowing where we come from, why we respond to things the way we do. Familiarity with life in various ways where we, you know, build a base of knowledge. There's wisdom to be had in knowledge. But not knowing is also helpful because, among other things, it tends to remind us what we're dealing with in life and in Zen practice, and that is a mystery. I was talking to my wife, who's a retired therapist, about this story of Fayan, and not knowing is most intimate. And her response as a therapist was, "Well, of course, because vulnerability is where we connect. When we don't know, we are vulnerable, and that's where we really connect with other people, is in that place of vulnerability, because it brings us to a place of intimacy. We draw close, and we ask ourselves, what is this? Who am I? What's going on? It's a point of view that's central in Zen, of course, but also in other similarly apophatic forms of religion. Apophatic is what's also sometimes called the via negativa, which is the way of unknowing, and as opposed to cataphatic, which is more the use of symbols and stories and things like that. And the apophatic tends to strip away, to emphasize the unknowing part of things. A good example, a couple of good examples in Christianity of this unknowing is the 16th century John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Soul, and his motto, which was nada, 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 nothing, nothing, nothing. I've often heard the term Dark Night of the Soul to refer to almost anything from a period of depression to a few blue days or something. But for John of the Cross, it was something much more specific. The Dark Night of the Soul was being reduced to a total lack of any spiritual consolation or understanding. Really not knowing. And being, as it were, lost. But also remaining in that place of trust. Remaining there and in that unknowing. And saying somehow yes to it. Or at least, okay. And that's really the dark night of the soul, is that trust in that place of that kind of emptiness. Another Christian place of unknowing is in the cloud of unknowing, by that title of 14th century English mystic who is anonymous. And that's both a theology and a practice of contemplative prayer, where what we call God or the experience of God is hidden behind, as it were, for this author, a cloud. It's as if one is facing a cloud and can't see the object of one's meditation or one's devotion, for that matter, and learning to accept that state as a kind of a permanent thing, living with mystery. So I want to talk about three different kinds of not knowing that I've experienced, and you will probably come up with a lot more, and I'm looking forward to the conversation about this. One of them is getting to a place of not knowing through life experience, life circumstances. Another is not knowing in relation to the Dharma. And thirdly, not knowing in terms of Zazen, and living out, actualizing Zazen in ordinary activities through the day. Awareness, Zen, Zazen awareness, as it were, in activity. So, for life circumstances, a lot of you know that for the past 7 years, a number of circumstances happened in my life that were extremely disruptive to my sense of self, my sense of identity. Both my parents died. I retired. I moved away from a place where I lived for 30 years. My wife had a life-threatening illness and surgery and recovery afterwards. There were just a lot of things that really turned everything upside down. And I was put in a place for the first time in my life that was so disorienting and unstable that I really didn't know, what am I doing? Why am I living here? What's going to happen in the future? Facing mortality, not knowing really who I am anymore, not knowing anything, and that's when some of this Zen literature, like Emperor Wu asking Bodhidharma after a particularly cryptic exchange, "Who is this that stands before me?" and Bodhidharma saying, "I don't know." That was extremely helpful to me, has been, for the past number of years, because we don't have to know. And there's a freedom in not knowing who we are anymore sometimes. If I mean, it can be it can be very painful. It can be very destructive even, and maybe there are ways in which not knowing who one is, you know, in forms of mental illness and other things are destructive. But the kind of not knowing I experienced and that I think Zen points to can be extremely liberating, to be freed of one's assumptions about self, about the world, about one's relationship to other people, about what one is doing, about what the future might hold. To be freed from that and really not know, it can be very scary, and it can be also extremely liberating and intimate, because we're at that point attuned to what is more rather than who we think we are or where we've been or where we're going. And it's not just, you know, the kind of disruptive things that I've been through. They can be so-called, I mean, yes, they can be an illness, they can be a bad diagnosis, they can be a divorce, a loss of some kind, but they can also be things that we've referred to as positive. I'm very aware of this. Both my sons, recently have had their first baby, boy, talk about disruptive, and talk about not knowing, really, not knowing. I mean, I've been sort of amazed once again, as I was when I had kids. You know, you can read books. There's a lot of stuff on the internet, and they can give you a manual about how to do it, but. You know, and then some of that's helpful, but on another level, it doesn't mean shit. I mean, you don't know what you have to make it up. You have to figure it out yourself, because the causes and conditions of the parents, the baby, the way their lifestyle, everything is totally unique, and you have to figure it out. And you really don't know. How do I get this kid to sleep? I've tried everything. I don't have any idea. And how do I go to work when I haven't had any sleep myself and get through a day? Who am I now that I'm not free to, you know, go out and stay out till 2 in the morning at interesting theater events and stuff like that? I mean, who am I now? I think mothers especially, who am I? It starts when they're pregnant with their bodies. It's suddenly strange to themselves in a way. It can happen. I have a nephew who very courageously at the age of 41 just finally came out to the world and his very conservative Roman Catholic family as gay. And wow, talk about not knowing. And the intimacy of that, of not knowing who he has been, who he's going to be, what's going to happen to his relationships with his family, his relationships to the church, a lot of things. And yet there's this kind of exhilarating intimacy in not knowing. So life circumstances can really bring us to a place of unknowing that can be kind of amazing. I've been reading recently Homeless Kodo Sawaki's that wonderful book, which there's some commentary on it, on little sayings that he has. And one of his short sayings is, "All human beings, without exception, are in reality homeless. It's a mistake to think we have a solid home." And obviously he's talking about more than just one's physical home or the place where you live. It's the willingness maybe to be fluid, to be flexible, to change as circumstances demand, to be really alive in a way that involves some risk. To be homeless is without a fixed identity that keeps one confined. And that's, of course, a form of emptiness. The second area that I want to talk about in terms of the intimacy of not knowing is the Dharma. There's this other wonderful story of Daowu and Shitu. Daowu asks, and this same question and answer happens a lot in Zen in different places. What is the great meaning of the Buddha Dharma? And Shitu says, not knowing. Sung San. Is that how you say his name, the Korean master? Sung San? How do you say that? Yeah, Sung San, the Korean Zen teacher, his real watchword, his phrase is only don't know, and in a book of that title, only don't know, only don't know, as a practice. I've been around a number of spiritual teachers and even Zen teachers who seem to think they really know what they're talking about. And there's nothing that turns me off more quickly than that, where there doesn't feel like there's any space for unknowing, where there's a certainty and a familiarity with the subject matter and just a kind of a fixed quality about it that doesn't allow room for something to happen in the talk. And I'm always refreshed by a spirit of something that Shunryu Suzuki said: a beginner's mind is wide open and questioning, an expert's mind is closed. Which is why Shunryu Suzuki always said it's important to keep beginner's mind all the way through, no matter how long we've been practicing or studying. I like to study. I like to study Buddhism in, it's a vast tradition. I feel like I'm, you know, after maybe 6 years of more intensive study than I've done in years past, I still feel like I'm just trying to get a drink from a fire hose. It's just so much. And it's infinitely faceted. And I read stuff, and I can't remember it. And I want to remember it. I want to write it down. And as Taiganis says, sometimes you want to write it down on a piece of paper and stick it on the wall and say, there it is. There's the Dharma. That's what it's about. Don't forget that to myself. But I can't. I mean, I can tell you what the Four Noble Truths are, and I could probably, if pressed, come up with the 16 precepts that I have taken vows to live. I might be able to get to the point where I could describe the content of different sutras somewhat. But after study, I'm often left with a feeling of that I'm kind of grasping at fog. What is it now? What is it now? And sometimes I feel that way after hearing a really good Dharma talk here. I'll go home and Susanna will say, well, what was the talk about? And I said, well, I'm not sure. But it was really good. Because the subject is about something that can't be confined to words or to an explanation. And so sometimes tongue-tied when I'm asked about this, which is why one of the refreshing things about Zen for me is that it's less explanatory than some other traditions and more expressive. It expresses the Dharma more than it tries to explain it. I feel like sometimes the proper approach to studying the Dharma is, rather than getting on a horse and putting the bit on it and riding it where you want it to go, it's like getting on a horse and just letting it go and saying, well, where are we going? Take me. And let me, you know, learn from where the Dharma might take me. So the last area is Zazen and awareness in daily life, or actualization in daily life. And as we know, you know, central to Zen is the question, what is this? What is this in the moment? It's a spirit of inquiry and curiosity and openness and engaging with what is, with suchness, with form as it emerges, as it changes, as it passes away. Taigen, in his book Zen Questions, which is a wonderful book, and he starts off by saying Zen Questions is not a statement about what Zen does so much as, it is a statement about what Zen does. Zen Questions. It's not, here are some Zen questions for you to consider. Zen Questions. And he has this wonderful passage. As we sit in meditation, thoughts, feelings, our whole world appears before us, not just the wall or the floor. Being present, upright, and gently aware in a settled posture, we can look at what is it that thus comes? How is it that this, just this, is here in front of me? What is it? How do I engage it? We do not need an answer to our question. To be present in the middle of the question is itself complete. So, Zazen is a act of curiosity about this moment. I was aware recently of how sometimes I feel like Zazen is similar in one way to being in danger and hiding, you know, without the danger, without the real danger and fear, but rather simply this quiet, very still alertness where one is closely attuned, you know, intimate with this moment as it's unfolding and listening and watching. And in this kind of heightened state of awareness, things are fresh. You can be surprised. What's that sound? What is that? There's this sense of attunement to the present moment that can come with not knowing what's going to happen next in the moment, in Zazen. Zazen also forces us into the position of not knowing who we are, not knowing what the self is. Who is this, or what is this that's generating thoughts? Is there a self that is having thoughts? If so, where is this self? What is it? If it's not there, how are the thoughts emerging? It's like that the book of that wonderful, the title of that wonderful book by Mark Epstein, Thoughts Without a Thinker. Well, what's that? So, in daily life, living out our Zazen and daily activity, one way of looking at it is that everything that ever happens, and this is always available to us, is for the very first time. I mean, I don't care how many times you've walked in through your front door and put the key in the lock and opened it up and walked in. Thousands of times, perhaps, if you've lived there a while. But it is a new experience. The weather that you're standing in is different. The color of maybe the leaves on a tree right there, a sound that goes by, your mood, your thoughts. It is a brand new moment. And that's always true. And that's obviously that's a form of not knowing what is this, and an intimacy also with what is this, which is the opposite of kind of a deadened habitual life where we're going on automatic pilot and we think we know what everything is and who we are in relationship to it. So those are just a few thoughts about not knowing and intimacy. And I would very much like to hear any responses you have to what I've said or other forms of not knowing and intimacy that you live with. Well, you know, you're making me think of something that I didn't say yet, and that is that there is a kind of knowing at the same time, that there's something you know that you knew when you first came in here, probably. And there's something we know about Zen practice. As unknowing as it is, it's like, I know this. I can't necessarily name it, but I know this. And it's the Dharma seeking the Dharma, or Zazen seeking Zazen, or Buddha seeking Buddha. It's something is recognized, and there's a knowing, a different kind of knowing. I think that dynamic, as you put it, between knowing and not knowing is also another part of it is, as Hogetsu and I have had some recent conversations about the drive to study and to study and to understand, and that it can be a form of bodhicitta, of the passion to delve into this, and there's something really good about that as well. And I think, you know, the kind of teachings on not knowing contextualize that, maybe. You were going to say something earlier.
So I was going to bring up Natalie Goldberg, who's a very well-known writing teacher, Buddhist practitioner. And the way she teaches is she gives you a prompt, which sometimes sounds nonsensical. It might be something about mashed potatoes or whatever. But then she invites you to just keep writing and don't let your hand stop. And it's a process of discovery. And one of her best prompts that I've ever heard is to write what you don't remember. I don't remember. And then you write, and you write what you don't remember. But, what's the purpose of writing? Anyway, it's really to connect with parts of your things that really you're not connected with, but they're, you don't know them, but you do know them, and so it's a it gives you access to try to connect with what you don't know.
That's beautiful.
And anyway, it's quite a beautiful process.
I was thinking about how the arts, I mean, really any kind of creative enterprise is a kind of not knowing. You hopefully you go into it not knowing what's going to happen. Whether it's theater or facing a blank canvas or even music that's all notated and written out, you don't exactly know what it's going to be like in the moment.
No, you don't. You wouldn't want to do that. That'd be boring.
Right.
My daughter's an artist, and when you're right, it's hard to explain Zen to people, but it's not so hard to explain it to an artist. They're doing the same thing.
And there's that intimacy with the material that comes from that. An image comes to mind of in one way we know who we are, we have certain habits and things we like to do and a personality and, you know, things. And that's like a home in a way, but this home, we learn, has all of its doors and windows are wide open. There's a lot blowing through there and things can change.
I was going to add to that by saying that, in fact, our interactions with different people are bringing out different aspects of ourselves all the time. So we, in fact, are, you know, everyone else all the time anyway, because, it just works that way. We're not a fixed entity, and we exist in that interaction.
Janet, you had something earlier?
This reminds me of Jesus Christ Superstar, the stage play, where Andrew Lloyd Wright, I think, was something like 20 years old when he wrote that. And at the end, the chaos that comes to the followers of Jesus after he dies is extraordinarily large. The people just don't know what happened. They don't know what to do. It's really interesting to see what happens when somebody that it's really interesting to see what happens to a culture, which I'm calling the followers of Jesus a culture, kind of fall apart when their expectations or the things that they knew are shown not to be true. And that's really all I have to say. I'm going through a whole bunch of things that I've read. For example, James Joyce's story called Ivy Day in the Committee Room, which is what happened to the followers of Parnell when he was discovered to be having an affair with a married woman. And this is, you know, Irish Catholic stuff. And the expectation was that, it was so expected that it wasn't even an expectation that he would never do anything like that. And what happened to his followers and how disorganized they were when suddenly they were confronted with not knowing. And I wonder, this was the biggest thing that attracted me to Buddhism, is I've gone around all this time not knowing anything and being disrespected because of it. And I'm now in this group where you're expected not to know.
Well, that quality is valued. Oh, good. That's good. That's good. How long do we have? I've forgotten when we stop this.
I would suggest maybe 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay. More? Okay. Yes, I'll get to it.
Such a wonderful thing to explore. No, I was struck by a couple things. One is that there's this, love of intimacy and not knowing. But there's another call online that I remember when a teacher was asked by their student, "Master, why is it that intimacy feels like enmity?" And I think there's also an antidote quality, an antidote to narcissism and self-clinging in intimacy, where when your expectations aren't met, like in a relationship, fall in love with somebody and all of a sudden you're disappointed. They don't want to go to the same restaurant, or who's hanging on the toilet seat, or you wanted to feel a certain way. And I feel like when we really know each other, it brings up also and challenges us, me, to look at how we actually want to know and want to fix things and fix people in certain categories or make people or everything in the world, the planet, into our personal assistant and redefine a sense of self. And so I think there's something very deep about intimacy and a great joy at that connection, but also this deep challenge to our sense of ego. There's that intimacy, riff on the Dullards, in The Debt, where, a husband and wife are married, and there's this deep experience that the wife has that the husband never knew. When you find out things about yourselves and the world. I was thinking about, I spent some time in a NICU with some very, very premature babies, 26 weeks old. And, your expectation with babies are oh, they're so cute and delightful. And these looked like little fetal pigs. They were bruised and tender and couldn't regulate their heart rate or their respiration. And there was nothing to do except just be with them and be with that unformed state. And I found it, it's intense. And I noticed there were very few people in the NICU, because I think it's really hard to have so many expectations and be around the tenderness and vulnerability of another being, especially your own baby. I was so surprised, because they develop better when they're held close, but you can't hold them too tight. And there's not, and this is our life, so there's a tension in it. It's a great opening when you're like, oh, I can let go of that. But there's also a pain of seeing my limitations and being open.
Intimacy is getting real, and that's not always comfortable. That Thomas Keating, the Trappist monk who started a whole movement called Centering Prayer, who just died fairly recently, in one of his early books talked about contemplative prayer as an experience of, especially when it's fairly new for someone, of suddenly turning on the lights really brightly in a room where it's been somewhat dark for a long time, and you start noticing all these little bugs and dust, and you know, you start noticing your thoughts, what they're really like, and you start noticing who you really are, and and it's a little disconcerting, as well as maybe other kinds of intimacy too.